Good evening. First of all, can I welcome everybody here on behalf of the school and also say how delighted and indeed honoured we are that the Geneva Association has agreed to hold what is now its 20th annual lecture here at the LSE. Its very first annual lecture was given here in this room 20 years ago by Kenneth Arrow, and since then a very distinguished cast list of speakers have delivered the Association's annual lecture, and today's lecture I'm sure will be no exception. We have quite a crowded programme today because as well as the lecturer we have four discussants invited by the Association to comment on the paper. That's going to mean that later on there'll be a kind of school prize-giving procession as they come up to give some comments. But I won't say any more, but I will now hand over to Mr. Roger Taylor, who is the Group Chief Executive of the Sun Alliance Group and is a board member of the Association, and is going to say one or two words both about the Association and about this evening's lecturer.
Thank you very much. If I might sit down and thank the London School of Economics for allowing us to have our lecture here, our 20th lecture, and also to thank John on my right for the hard work he's put into making the arrangements for tonight. Perhaps before introducing Professor Denny Kessler to you, I could just make a word or two comment about the Geneva Association. The full name of the Geneva Association is the International Association for the Study of Insurance Economics, founded in 1971, first assembly in Paris in 73, and it's a voluntary body represented by presidents and chief executive officers of insurance companies. Its purpose is to support and encourage research in the economics of the whole spectrum of insurance-related issues, risk, uncertainty, regulation, financing, market behavior, but on a worldwide basis. It regularly produces and circulates papers which are contributed by academics and practitioners both within and outside of the insurance industry, and of course it organises conferences and seminars. The purpose of the Geneva Association is to cast light upon and stimulate debate upon key insurance issues of a strategic nature and importance, and this annual lecture has attracted many speakers of distinction, and I'm particularly delighted tonight that Professor Denny Kessler has consented to address us on a, I think, a very topical and thought-provoking subject. Denny Kessler, as he's known to me, is a very well-known personality in the French insurance world, indeed in the European insurance world, where his principal career, though he has many interests, is to be president of the French Federation of Insurance Companies. He's also chairman of the scientific committee of the Geneva Association, and he's a professor of economics in Paris, and he's also a board member of the CBI equivalent body in Paris. He's a thoroughly entertaining individual, great fun, a bon viveur, but when he has a moment or two he also writes and publishes many books and papers. But that's Denny Kessler. A great pleasure to see him here tonight, and I'd like to invite him now to present the 20th annual lecture. Denny.
Very great pleasure for me to be here tonight at the London School of Economics. I remember quite a few years ago, about 6 or 7 years ago, invited by Tony Atkinson, I gave a lecture on the 19th century. I've been invited again, so I hope I did not do such a bad job last time I came. And I've been invited to give the 20th annual lecture of the Geneva Association. You have to know that this event is usually done and by great names. We have had certainly the greatest names in economics for the last 20 years. People like Kenneth Harrow, people like Josh Stiglitz, Martin Feldstein, Tony Atkinson, Pierre Pestiot, Jacques Drez, Edmond Malinvaux, and so on. And I must say, and I must really tell you, that I have no idea why tonight I took part in this long line of world-renowned economists and scholars. You know, seems to me that my name is on a movie, you know, and where you have Hugh Grant on one side and Dennis Kessler on the other side, and everyone is asking, who is Dennis Kessler? The guy who climbs up a mountain. Anyway, it cannot be denied that over the decades to come, there will be much debate, criticism, and questioning on the whole issue of intergenerational transfers. In fact, the demographic upheaval that industrialized countries will have to go through will bring about a breakdown in the relative equilibrium of present-day intergenerational transfer mechanism. We will first see tonight that this demographic breakdown has no precedent. It will affect the whole spectrum of transfers, whether going up or down the generation chain, whether public or private, whether being the result of individual or collective choice. For me, it is vital that a real policy for the management of these transfers be implemented if we are to avoid the tension or indeed conflict that would be detrimental to the cohesion of society and which, if it were allowed to worsen, could result in very serious crisis situations. When I talk about intergenerational transfers, in other words, expenditures on training, education, when I talk about bequest, when I talk about social security expenditures in front of an audience, I always have to ask a question. I hope that neither my parents or my children are in the audience. If they are in the audience, please refer to the front desk. I have a few explanations to give to my parents as far as inter vivos bequest is concerned, and a few details to give to my children as far as education expenditures are concerned. Let's start by the unprecedented demographic breakdown. To outline the current and especially the future evolution of the relative balance of the various age groups, we must examine in order the evolution of the birth rate and then mortality and finally migratory phenomena. The first question we can ask is the birth rate down for the long term? In almost all industrialized countries, the fertility rate, which had been very high since 1945, collapsed in the mid-60s. The similarities in the changes in demographic behavior among the OECD countries is very striking. Why did the baby boom come to an end everywhere at almost the same time, whereas there are so many differences between these countries, such as, for example, religious beliefs, the relative level of development, urban density, or the number of women in the workforce? No really convincing argument has been put forward to explain this shift from the baby boom to the baby bust. Just showing these graphs, you can see that something happened in Japan in the year 1964, as far as I remember. It's not a statistical mistake. It was the year of the horse of the fire, and lots of Japanese decided not to make any children. You can see a sharp drop of the fertility rate for only 1 year. The fact that it is practically impossible to explain the past trend in the birth rate makes it difficult to give an outline of its future. As a matter of fact, two approaches exist. The first one postulates that the birth rate is cyclical. It can be presented very simply. A full generation produces an empty one, and an empty generation produces a full one. The opposite theory claims that birth rate patterns are not necessarily reversible, which, if true, means that the decline we have seen over the last 30 years will be lasting. Industrialized societies would then have entered a long period of low birth rates. The question regarding the future trend in the birth rate is an important one, primarily in order to appreciate the very long-term relative balance among the various coexisting generations. In any case, these questions of a possible return to high birth rates is important, but not paramount, if we do not look beyond the next 30 years. In fact, the real change in the relative balance among the age groups will take place no matter what happens, because those children who have not been born over the last 30 years will never be born. Is the mortality rate declining steadily? The trend in the mortality rates is also well known. Mortality rates per age group fall constantly as the generations come and go. If we look at the evolution of life expectancy over a long period in France, we started in the year 1806, you will note that the real acceleration of life expectancy occurred mainly in the second half of the 20th century. One can see, for example, that life expectancy for men went from 45 years old in the year 1900 to 74 years in 1994. Life expectancy for women rose from 47 years in the year 1900 to 82 in 1994, respectively. We have stressed the converging patterns in birth rates in the various developed countries. We can make the same observation with respect to the trend in mortality rates. Life expectancy has increased for all industrialized countries, reaching more or less identical levels today. This too is quite remarkable, as these countries do not have the same per capita income, social security system, or even the same nutritional habits. How will the mortality rate evolve over the decades to come? Here too, there are two approaches. The first one maintains that only the well-known phenomenon of the orthogonalization or squaring of the survival curves will continue. Survival curves at a given age become increasingly higher from one generation to another. But the maximum lifetime duration does not move much, which would mean an increasingly greater concentration of age groups at death if the phenomenon continued. You can see here on this graph the two different approaches. The first approach is a squaring of the survival curve. This is the yellow curve going to the converging towards the blue curve. And as you see, the age omega, which is the maximum duration of lifetime, doesn't move. The second approach is based on the probable, through unquantified, change in the maximum life duration as more significant discoveries are made in the treatment of cancer, cardiovascular diseases, and other common deadly illnesses. This theory is reinforced further by possibilities created through genetic therapies. In this case, the survival curve will change again in the next century as omega will move to omega prime, which means that the maximum duration of lifetime will suddenly increase by 10 or 15 years. The majority of available population projections are based on the assumption that the phenomenon of the orthogonalization of the survival curves will continue. Of course, if the maximum duration of life, the age omega, were to change dramatically in the future, these population projections would be wrong. It is not an easy task to choose between these two theories, but it should be noted that the underlying continuation of orthogonalization of the survival curves is already bringing about an upheaval in the relative balance among age groups. We tend to think, however, that a sharp increase in the size of the troops of the very old is a real possibility. We think that we will certainly see during the next century a sharp increase in the age omega. Are migratory phenomena on the decrease? The relative balance among age groups depends also on a third phenomenon, migratory fluctuations. Whether in the case of emigrations or immigration, migration fluctuations directly affect the relative balance among age groups and consequently the demographic perspectives underlying the projection of intergenerational transfers. It is well known that it is hard to estimate the trend of migration movements. In fact, these movements depend on a great number of factors, in particular political ones, which are difficult to set up as models. In the industrialized countries, the propensity to emigrate is nowadays very low. Even if it is possible to put forward the idea that European integration should result in greater intra-European population flows than in the past, this phenomenon would nevertheless probably remain limited. A nuance is required regarding this comment. If aging were to create too great a tax and social burden for the active population, this part of the population might be inclined to eliminate the burden by by immigrating to countries with a young demographic structure and with lower social charges. Population would move from zones of high pressure taxation and social charges to low pressure zones. With respect to immigration fluctuations, Europe as a whole changed its policy in 1973, as you all know, and the migratory fluctuations have slowed considerably since that date. In this case, it is not the desire of foreigners to immigrate into Europe, which has diminished, of course, but rather Europe's desire to accept them, which has. While avoiding rash projections in this area, we can still put forward the idea that a change of immigration policy should not be dismissed if continuation of the phenomena in birth rate and mortality rate were to result in an intolerable disparity in the relative balance among age groups. With the stagnation of the birth rate, the increase in survival rates and migratory fluctuations probably reduced, the age structure of European populations is going to evolve substantially. Let us show the latest projection to highlight the magnitude of the upheaval in the age pyramid which will take place over the decades to come in the case of France. Here are the age pyramids for 1994. Here is the age pyramid in the year 2020 with three different hypotheses, three birth rate assumptions, 1.5, the blue, 1.8, the green, and 2.1, the rose part of this graph. These charts alone show the considerable upheaval in age categories due to birth rate and mortality rate fluctuations. Look at the year 2050. As you can see, the entire age pyramid has changed, and the aged part of the population are the majority in the population. As you can see, you have a declining size of generations that would take place once again, especially in the case where the fertility rate would go to 1.5 children per woman. The most striking phenomenon is indeed the relative increase in the size of the older generations. As of the turn of the next century, an increase which will have a real impact on all the mechanism for age-related redistribution of resources. When considering the aging of population, changes in fertility rates is often presented as the most important factor, followed by changes in mortality rates. Computations they have done in the case of France show, to the contrary, that over a 70 years period of time, changes in mortality account for almost two-thirds of aging, whereas changes in fertility rates account for only one-third of the aging phenomenon. To illustrate this impact, we can show the net fluctuation of the age 60-plus population from now on to the year 2050. It can be seen that the net annual increase in people over 60 will be between 250,000 and 350,000 each year for more than 20 years. Available projection of population in the first half of the 21st century shows that all industrialized countries experience a similar phenomenon. The importance of aging varies, however. Countries that have already experienced an aging phenomenon, like the UK, will tend to age less in the future than countries having known a very strong post-war baby boom, such as the US, Japan, France, or Germany. How could one imagine that such an upheaval in the relative balance among age categories will have no economic and social effects? In our society, there is a permanent overlapping of great many forms of exchange and transfers between the coexisting generations. They can be private, in which case they are mainly organized within the family, or they can be public, in which case they are subject to decisions made by public authorities. They may be ascending, in other words, going from the children to the parents, or from young people to older people, or they may be descending. They may also take the form of cash or time, or they may be exchanges in kind. When we try to put on a graph the table of all the possible intergenerational transfers. You end up with a table showing the private transfers within the family, descending ones, inheritance, gifts, financial aid, low interest loans from parents to children, educational spending. You have ascending transfers in within the family, such as gifts from children to parents or financial aid. And of course, you have the other part of the graph, which are the public state-organized transfers, descending ones, such as family allowances, unemployment benefits benefiting to the very young. But you have also the large ascending transfers, such as, for instance, public debt. You have also social security, especially when they work on a pay-as-you-go basis. You have also a lot of health expenditures benefiting the older part of the population. What do we find when an attempt is made at putting a figure on these various intergenerational transfers? First, public and social transfers tend to go back up the generation chain. In other words, to go from the young, active generations to the older ones. This is obviously the case of pay-as-you-go pension plans. These transfers have not ceased to increase over the last 50 years. The ascending generational direction of public and social transfers can also be seen in health insurance spending, also to a lesser extent. Given the distribution of health spending per age, it is clear that a large part of health insurance transfers are for older persons. If we leave the social area and look at areas for which the government is directly responsible, the increasing burden of public debt is to be mentioned. When a state finances are in deficit at a given date in time because it does not collect all the resources to finance its spending, it places a burden on its future generations. Indeed, this means that future generations of taxpayers will be called upon to reimburse the public debt, thus restricting their disposable income. Naturally, this line of reasoning is tempered by the fact that some public spendings are targeted towards lasting investments from which future generations will also benefit. However, it is nevertheless true that the public debt has increased dramatically over the past few years as public deficits deepened. The government, however, also implements transfers which go down the generation chain. This means primarily public spending on education and training. To this must be added other public expenditures, such in a certain number of countries, such as family allowances. A more detailed study of a distribution by age group and by generation, both of resources and public social spending, would obviously be necessary to better define the magnitude and direction of redistribution implemented by the government. However, this necessity will certainly not contradict the observation that the net balance of public and social transfers is today largely in favor of the older generations. With respect to private transfers, we note that most of these go down the generation chain, and this is a very striking difference between the public transfers going up and the private transfers going down. This is a case of private spending on education and training, and also of parental assistance to children. Finally, it is also the case of all inter vivos bequests and inheritances. However, the amount of these transfers, which are more difficult to evaluate, appears much less than public and social transfers. Obviously, the time and attention, which are non-monetary variables, which the older generations give to the younger ones, would have to be added in order to have a more precise idea of the size and direction of private transfers between coexisting or successive generations. According to available figures, private intergenerational transfers are tending to increase. It would appear that this is the case for assistance, inheritances and gifts, and it can be explained by the relative enrichment over the last few decades of the older generations. If we lump together all public and private intergenerational transfers, we arrive most certainly at a balance which works out in favor of the older generations. This balance is mainly the result of collective intervention which, whether deliberately or not, appear to have generously favored the older generations during the last few decades by organizing a massive mandatory transfer of resources towards the top of the age pyramid. Many facts bear witness to the intensity of these transfers. Let us take two examples in the case of France. First, the standard of living of older people expressed in units of consumption using the Oxford scale, Tommy, is on average higher than that of the working population. And second, the average age of consumers is substantially greater than that of the producers. This is true of the average age, it is true also of the median age. The government, within the wider meaning of the term, has become the empire between the generations. It has de facto chosen to privilege the older generations. Is this a conscious choice? Is it a voluntary one? Is it a serious choice? But above all, is it sustainable, and can it last in the face of an accelerating aging of the population? To answer these questions, we have to recall the foundations of intergenerational transfers and distinguish between the foundations of private and public intergenerational transfers. We will see that there are very many reasons that are put forward to explain the direction and the size of transfers between generations. When we look at the private intergenerational transfers, there have been for the last 20 years a whole series of research studies. The basis of private transfers implemented by households are contained in at least four, perhaps even five, paradigms. First, the unawareness or uncertainty paradigm. Many transfers appear involuntary. This can be true, for instance, of inheritances, uncertainty of lifetime leading to unwanted inheritances. The second paradigm that we find in the literature is the paternalism paradigm. According to this paradigm, individuals transfer resources to other generations as a status symbol, allowing them to demonstrate their authority or their power. Leaving and transferring in this case increases mainly the utility of the giving generation, as in King Lear. The altruism paradigm is the third one. In this case, individuals care about the welfare of other generations. Through the transfer of resources, they try to equalize the standard of living from one generation to another. They take into account in their choices the utility of the other generations, of the recipients. And if the gap between welfare levels tended to get wider, compensatory transfers would take place. The fourth paradigm is the strategy paradigm. In this case, the various generations are involved in relations of a strategic nature. For example, the older generations seek to obtain care and time from the younger ones, and to do so, exercise a sort of blackmail. The younger generations, interested in obtaining the wealth of the older ones, would become involved in complex relationship where each party tries to get the most out of it for itself. There would be a certain kind of generational selfishness. The fifth paradigm would be that of market relations between the generations. Even if exchange conditions are not obvious straight away, we could consider certain transfers seemingly made with no consideration as in fact the price paid in exchange for previous services or services to be rendered later. Thus, for instance, spending on education would be the price to be paid for having a retirement pension later on. In reality, private transfers between generations are certainly a subtle mix of all these paradigms. In other words, uncertainty, paternalism, altruism, strategy, and market exchanges. But also private transfers are implemented by businesses. These transfers are the result of provisions such as seniority rules, or mechanism for termination indemnities, or indeed some kind of private pension plans. The foundations of public intergenerational transfers are quite different. They are to be found first and foremost in the idea that the spontaneous distribution of resources between the generations, such as that resulting from giving free rein to behavior and the markets, is not optimal, either from the point of view of efficiency or from that of equity. Thus, Government intervention is considered necessary to effect transfers of resources in order to correct the primary distribution of resources. We can illustrate this comment by examining the issue of public spending on education. If parents do not invest sufficiently in the education of their children, the human capital accumulation rate will be insufficient and economic growth slowed down for the long term. For this to happen, it is sufficient to observe that the social rate of return of education expenditures is greater on average than the private rate of return, or to take another example, the performance hoped for or perceived by families from investment in education is lower than actual performance. Consequently, public spending on education is, in a sense, represents a mandatory investment from which the whole community benefits, current and coming generations. However, this public expenditure can also be justified by the fact that certain households do not possess the necessary resources to finance educational spending. In this case, it is the principle of equity which justifies this public intervention of mandatory resource transfers between generations. An analogous form of reasoning can be outlined with regard to retirement-based transfers. Government intervention for sharing resources between coexisting age categories is usually based on the following. First, the asymmetrical information paradigm. Individuals, or a certain proportion of them, do not have the necessary information to make optimal choices. Asymmetrical information can generally explain some of the dysfunction in insurance markets. And lastly, the government does not have the information to target its intervention, or the requisite information would cost too much to obtain. Second paradigm for government intervention in the allocation of resources between generations is a preference for the present paradigm. In this case, individuals are supposed impatient, and consequently their time horizon is limited. This leads them not to pay sufficient attention to events that they think will happen beyond their time horizon. The government's discount rate would be lower, corresponding to maximization of collective utility, and it would constrain the economic choices of private agents. The third paradigm is the insufficient risk aversion paradigm. Even if a perfect knowledge of risk is assumed, certain individuals might not seek to protect themselves adequately through incompetence or lack of foresight. They would overexpose themselves and their relatives to risk. And if the risk materializes, the individuals might end up in a situation calling for public intervention. The imperfection of the markets paradigm is well known. Here the markets are imperfect and do not allow people to protect themselves through time in the best way. Thus, implementation of public programs is justified. The classical example is the implementation of pay-as-you-go social security system to finance pensions. Such systems are notably supposed to be the response to the failures of capital markets. Explanations concerning public debt are different, it's so well known that I don't think I have to recall them, going from the financing of public investment to the smoothing of the cycle and to the spreading of the cost of war over a certain number of generations. These brief and incomplete developments as to the foundations of public and private intergenerational transfers show that they are based on very different principles. For each transfer, considered individually, several explanations can always be put forward. Just to explain inheritances, you have a whole series of hypotheses to explain one single intergenerational transfer. An examination of these hypotheses raises several questions. First, are intergenerational transfers implemented consciously or voluntarily, or are they the result of a whole series of uncoordinated private and public decisions? Second question, do intergenerational transfers lead to an equalizing of levels of well-being from one generation to another? Third, do intergenerational transfers aim mainly at obtaining more efficient allocation of resources between the generations than that obtained by the original spread? And finally, fourth, do intergenerational transfers interact with each other, with public transfers supplanting or supplementing private ones, and descending transfers, for instance, compensating or not compensating ascending transfers. The question here is everything neutral, all transfers being substitutable, or is everything not neutral, transfers being set one by one. Whatever the answers to these questions, all intergenerational transfers will be affected by the aging of the population. The aging process will first of all affect the primary distribution of resources by age. It will be reflected by substantial changes in the magnitude of private and public transfers. The allocation of available resources among age categories is based on very diverse phenomena. We shall briefly consider primary income and wealth distributions first, in that order. Activity is no doubt the paramount phenomenon, as it is the one which fixes the primary distribution of resources among the age categories. We know that activity rates have evolved over the past 30 years, with a leveling out of male activity rates, both at the beginning of adult life, studies lasting longer, and as of age 50, phenomenon of early retirement. Thus, the volume of primary income has become heavily concentrated on a fraction of the population. Furthermore, unemployment, which is particularly high at the beginning and at the end of a career, is compressing even further age-based distribution of income. If we add the fact that, as a general rule, wages are also an increasing function of age, the concentration of primary income according to age is still greater than that can be supposed from the mere distribution of labor force participation rates. The aging of the population should result in a steady rise in the average age of the producers. As we can see in the case of France, in the year 2005, there will be most probably a decrease in the active population as the full generations of the post-war baby boom leaves the labor force. This situation will certainly be common to most industrialized countries. The aging of the active population, and certainly the shrinking of the active population, raises three questions. First, the evolution of net income, which will depend on the fiscal and social decisions made during the years to come. Second, the evolution of productivity. Even assuming a relatively strong fluctuation of productivity according to age, it seems that variations in average productivity caused by the aging of the active population would remain relatively modest. Third, the evolution of seniority rules. The role of age in the distribution of wages will no doubt change greatly in the years to come. It would appear that this mechanism will be reviewed gradually as the age-related structure of the active population loses its shape. Seniority rules are easy to implement during periods when the active population is young, but very expensive in period of aging. Let's look now at the situation of savings, inheritance, and aging. What is the initial position? It is that of an important concentration of wealth according to age. This can be explained by the traditional effect of age, but also by a range of generational effects. Wealth is, at present, mainly concentrated at the top of the age pyramid. Indeed, the current older generations have been particularly privileged as regards wealth accumulation. Throughout the 80s, older people have benefited from the spectacular appreciation of the price of personal assets due to the rise in stock prices and real estate. Their investment income increased greatly because it was they who held the major part of the yield-bearing assets. At the same time, retirement rights for successive generations have become greater and greater, and pensions have been constantly over-indexed. Consequently, older people have not had to sell personal assets because they had enough regular income to allow them to finance the period off the labor market. On the other hand, the younger generations were much less favored by this period. They have been hit by unemployment. High interest rates have dissuaded them from purchasing a house, and a substantial portion of their monthly payment consist of the payment of high interest rather than repayment of principal. The uninterrupted increase in social and fiscal contributions, the increase of the tax burden, has restricted the increase in their disposable income, which was already affected by a slowing down in the growth of purchasing power. Thus, it is not surprising that their rate of saving has stagnated or decreased. What will be the effect of aging on saving and the distribution of wealth? The most common assumption is that the savings rate will rise over the coming years as the full post-war generations come of saving age. Worried by the prospects of the welfare state, the baby boom generations would make a substantial savings effort to accumulate wealth. Of course, this increase would be later on followed in about 30 years by a very sharp drop of the savings rate. What about inheritance and aging? Until recently, inheritance seems to have played a minor role. This situation would change radically in the years to come. There would be a very strong increase in descending intergenerational flows of wealth. In other words, inheritances, inter vivos bequests, gifts, and assistance of all sorts would see an unprecedented increase in popularity, at least in modern history. The generations which are going to disappear will bequeath upon death to the coming maturing generation or transmit during their lifetimes the wealth which they succeeded in accumulating under good conditions. More substantial asset transfers will be made to less wealthy generations. Slowly but surely, there will be a move from wealth acquired through savings to wealth acquired through inheritance. This phenomenon of an increase in inheritances, which had been somewhat postponed due to the steady rise in life expectancy, will continue to accelerate. This coming boom in inheritances and gifts has also been demonstrated across the Atlantic. The volume of inheritances is apparently increasing strongly in the United States and will roughly be multiplied by 10, the amount of, in total, billions of US dollars of estates that would be transferred from to the young generations would be multiplied by 10 within the next 15 years. Let's have just one word on retirement and aging. As you know, now it's well known, pay-as-you-go pension schemes will inevitably be the first to be affected by aging of the population. Naturally, it will be the pay-as-you-go plans which will be most directly affected. An OECD study, whose assumptions are, however, rather conservative, has shown that public expenditures for retirement will increase from now to the year 2030 by more than 40% in Germany and Italy, by more than 30% in Belgium and the United Kingdom, by more than 60% in the Netherlands, and especially by more than 75% in France. The prospects for public pension schemes are very worrying. Demographic prospects are such that, in the end, we will have to choose between a sharp increase in contributions or a sharp drop in the replacement ratio. In France, the contribution rate, expressed as a percentage of the average income of the working population, would rise from 20% in 1990 to almost 40% in the year 2035. Or the reverse, if we decide to maintain the contribution rate as its 1990 level, it would cause the replacement ratio to fall from 70% to 35%. Will the pay-as-you-go system be able to adapt? The solutions are well known. They consist of increasing contributions and or budgetary financing. It consists of pushing back the average retirement age, and it consists in lowering the relative value of pensions. They are and will be hard to implement for economic, social, and political reasons. Whether we like it or not, aging will affect all occupational and public welfare programs, handling transfers between age categories, and even more so between successive generations. We can let these transfers go down the drain, which will create rapidly uncontrollable tension, or we can manage them, which will enable us to renew the fundamental social contract. I think that active management of the allocation of resources between generations is absolutely essential. Taking into account the prospects due to the aging of the European populations, all of the mechanisms for the transfer of resources between the age categories will be given a rough ride. There are competing demands for sharing national income. As the income of the active population is not necessarily going to expand significantly, mainly because of the stagnation, indeed the decrease in the number of active people, which will take place as of the beginning of the next century, allocation among the coexisting age categories will most likely be a source of increasing tension. We have no experience of the sharing of resources between four coexisting generations. It has never been experienced, and we can see that the equilibrium to reach is going to be hard to reach. Of course, we need a better understanding of the concept of justice between generations. Whether public or private, income and wealth transfers modify the intergenerational distribution of well-being. What are the criteria to assess the resulting well-being distribution between successive generations? How can one say that such and such intergenerational transfer is redistributive or anti-redistributive? How can one state that a given distribution of well-being between successive generations is preferable to another distribution? What are the guidelines that a government can follow in order to maintain justice between coexisting and successive generations? To answer these very basic questions that we will have to answer in all industrialized countries is not an easy task. First, we all know how it is difficult to compare the well-being of different generations, since all of their characteristics vary over time. Second, the concept of equality between successive generations is of course absolutely not relevant. The comparison between the intergenerational and the intragenerational distributions of income is indeed meaningless. Why should the average well-being of each successive generation be equal? Third, the comparison a la Kotlikoff of the balances between what a generation has received from other generations through public transfers and what it has given through taxes is also subject to critics. Even in including all possible transfers from exhaustible resources to inheritances, a positive balance may not lead to a definite conclusion that this generation is a winner or a loser. An accounting framework will not be sufficient to assess the relative well-being of generations. Fourth, the use of an intergenerational collective utility function is certainly appealing, but we all know here that its specification raises numerous theoretical questions, not to talk about, of course, empirical relevance. The maximization of such a collective utility function would certainly determine the optimal level of consumption of each successive generations. But we have a large number of problems to be solved. I will only mention two of them. How do we weight the utility of each generation according to its size? How do we choose the discount rate in order to choose the optimal stream of resources or consumption between the successive generations? Fifth, the question of equity and ends of justice is even more perverse. Many transfers, such as inheritance or income transfers through pay-as-you-go schemes, appear somehow reciprocal. I have inherited some wealth from my parents, and therefore I will transfer some wealth to my children. I have financed the retirement period of my parents, and therefore I expect my children to finance my own retirement period. We face here the problem of intergenerational commitments. We see here that if one generation changes the rule of the game, for instance, refuses to pay their contributions to the pay-as-you-go schemes or consumes all inherited wealth without leaving later a bequest, the chain letter mechanism comes to an end, all previous or later transfers introducing a bias in the distribution of well-being between successive generations. Who can argue that there will be never a generation ending the chain letter mechanism of pay-as-you-go schemes? Who can argue that there will never be a government changing radically the taxation of inheritance? Most of the transfers between generations will always be made in the context of uncertainty about the behavior of not yet born generations. The concept of justice between generations needs, of course, further analysis. Even if one cannot define exactly the concept of equality or equity between generations, it seems that if one generation appears to benefit too much from intergenerational transfers, at the expense of previous or future generations, there might be tensions and conflicts. We assume here that the situation described is a sharp deviation from the historical trend of intergenerational transfers. There are indeed, for the future, two very contrasting scenarios. According to the first scenario, this tension will get worse and might even degenerate. If nothing is done, it is certain that there will be generations who will benefit from the aging process and others that will suffer from it. There will be winners and there will be losers, as David Thompson argued. Certain generations, for instance, today's young active population, and the generations who will reach the age of employment in the decades to come, might be required to shoulder a very large part of the cost associated with aging. We could experience what is called in literature, to use Margaret Mead's expression, a generation conflict. Certain generations, in this case the emerging generations, might consider that the burden placed on their shoulders is too heavy. Seeing their income drastically reduced by increased public and social withholdings, constantly doubting that there will be any subsequent return from these withholdings, the rising generations might question the choices made by the government. Wishing to protect their standard of living, they might express their refusal to be made to contribute beyond what they see as fair by political and, if necessary, by non-political means. The feeling of unfairness or injustice is a powerful one, and it has been at the root of many social conflicts throughout the world. The problem would be worsened by the consequences of the aging of the electoral body. The electoral will get older, since the average age of the elector will certainly increase in the decades to come. If one assumes that each generation tries, above all, to maximize its own interest when voting, the increasing influence of the older generations would end up by sharing available national resources in their favor. Politicians would be unable to escape this pressure and would be inclined to favor the elderly electorate. According to the second scenario, our societies would take the necessary steps in time to avoid this conflict. Also, these may sometimes be painful. Rather than passively allowing transfers between generations to evolve in favor of some and to the detriment of others, the government, who is responsible for implementing the major part of ascending transfers, would take the necessary steps to avoid any distortion in the allocation of resources among the age categories. The government would exercise its role of arbitrator between the generations by succeeding in establishing rules for maintaining a just and fair sharing of resources and ensuring that they are respected. According to the second scenario, the government would not be a prisoner of narrow-minded electioneering, and the generations, upon voting, would seek the common interest rather than their own. In any case, taking into account the importance of public and private intergenerational transfers, it is necessary to identify and measure them better, to evaluate their effects and master them better, in a word, to manage them better, given the responsibility for the government in the area of transfers between generations. There will have to be a real political debate to determine the rules for collective action. Given the prospects for a very strong increase in transfers, limits will have to be put down to budget the transfers of resources between generations, for two reasons. First, so that they do not have adverse economic and social consequences on the labor market, on savings, on international competitiveness. And second, so that they do not have anti-redistribution consequences. Naturally, these norms would be over time. budgets would have to be defined for several decades in order to fight against any kind of public short-termism. We shall perhaps somewhat recklessly to end up outline a few rules which would respect both the principles of intergenerational fairness, of intergenerational justice between coexisting and successive generations, and the principles of intergenerational efficiency, the pursuit of the accumulation of wealth throughout time. The first rule is a very easy one. I think that we should invest massively in initial training. We should reform most of the education system in industrialized countries so it makes a better contribution to the professional integration of the young generations. We are entering an era where the supply of the active population will slow down as a result of the drop in the birth rates. Consequently, it will be necessary to ensure that the generations which are numerically the smallest are qualitatively better trained. Investment in training is a priority because the quality of human capital remains one of the essential sources of productivity gains and therefore of growth. The second rule is an extension of active life. This requires, in particular, pushing back the age limits for terminating employment and also making deep changes in the ways in which this is done. Such an extension of active life could coincide with the development of concepts such as part-time work, flex-time work, sabbatical leaves. Obviously, such an extension of active life is justified by the extension of life itself. Third rule, we should base social contributions on total income. In a certain number of countries, such as France, the current method of financing social transfers is through payroll taxes. It leads to too great a generational concentration of resources. Thus, a movement towards a broad-based contribution systems appears preferable in a period of population aging in order to avoid a minority of the population having to bear the burden of these compulsory contributions tomorrow. Fourth, we should encourage the young to vote. Data available on enrollment, on voting lists, and on actual voting show that the younger generations use their voting rights less than the elders. Given the fact that the aging process increases the average age of voters and the importance of the role of the authorities in allocating resources among the generations, young people must be strongly encouraged to take part in democratic life by voting. One may wonder whether the introduction of compulsory voting in force in some European countries today would not be a means, among others, to avoid a certain bias in the expression of the general good in a situation of aging. Fifth rule, it is necessary to modify the age-income relationship. A review of the provisions linking salary and age, which still exist in a large number of sectors and businesses, should help to improve relations between generations, to favor the employment of young people, and also to improve the relations between generations. I think it is also to keep the elderly, it appears necessary to innovate and to find new ways of remunerating work over the whole life course. We should rethink the policy on health. The distribution of healthcare spending according to age is partly the reflection of choice of policy on healthcare. Thus, a strict control of health insurance spending helps to slow down increasing intergenerational transfers, which cuts back the net income of the active population. Moreover, the development of prevention would rebalance age-related health spending. We should control public deficits. Control of deficits and a policy of gradually absorbing the accumulated public debt will help in the future to slacken the noose of compulsory contributions. Such a policy of budgetary rigor is all the more necessary as the government invests less than in the past, in other words, as the accumulation of public assets grows less quickly than its liabilities. We should refrain from creating social deficits. Also, it is possible to envisage a deficit in public finances once the government goes ahead with investments. There is no excuse for social financing deficits. the financing of transfer expenditures through borrowing seems wholly unjustified. In reality, social programs should generate surpluses in order to provide for a large part of future charges. We should encourage a huge effort in long-term saving for retirement. Governments should, and should do so even more in the future, encourage people to finance their retirement by saving in order to avoid placing the financial burden of population aging on future generations. In time, this extra accumulation of resources will increase the level of national income, thus facilitating the continuation of immediate transfer mechanisms between the generations. Indeed, fresh savings make it possible to finance the investment required to return to growth. Some of the beneficial effects of this accumulation of long-term savings created by the mechanism of individual and group funding arrangements would be a strengthening of the financial markets and favoring the optimal allocation of capital, ensuring a non-inflationist financing of the economy, helping eventually to bring down real interest rates, encouraging investment, competitiveness and employment. And finally, we should encourage the transmission of wealth. As the transmission of wealth, inter vivos bequest, assistance, inheritances is a phenomenon of the reduction of inequality between generations, encouraging bequest and assistance, and refraining from increasing inheritance taxes should help to avoid an increase in the wealth assets gap between the generations. Let me conclude in saying that the greatness of nations lies usually in their ability to ask themselves at the right time the key questions which govern the future. The present system of private and public intergenerational transfers cannot last in the long run. The continuation of this system is impossible in view of the aging of the population. Therefore, it will have to be modified in order to keep predictable tensions from degenerating into real conflicts. The sooner, the better. Thank you.
If you would bear with us for about a minute while we reorganise the stage and the four discussants perhaps join us up here. We have some chairs about to appear as well. Anybody would like to? We have a rather limited time left, but we have four extremely distinguished discussants who have agreed to make some short comments on the paper. And in the absence of any other rule for equity between them, if perhaps I could take comments in alphabetical order, and therefore start with Professor Tony Atkinson, the Warden of Nuffield College, Oxford, and too well known, I'm sure, to everybody here to need any more introduction. Tony.
Thank you. Thank you. On Monday, I had a fax saying I had 10 minutes to give my discussion. On Tuesday, I had a fax saying I had five minutes to make my discussion. I didn't like to go into the office yesterday because I think even 10 minutes wouldn't really be enough to do justice to what has been a very rich and stimulating, thought-provoking lecture. What I'd like to do is to make three brief points, all concerned with differences. First of all, the point which Denny himself made quite clearly, which is that the UK is different as far as its demographics are concerned. One of the tables showed, for example, the population age 65 plus as a proportion of the total. And I'd just like to bring out of that a few figures which underline the difference. Between 1990 and 2020, the proportion in the UK rises by 1.2 percentage points. In Germany, France and Italy, it rises by about 6 percentage points. And over the period from 1990 to 2050, it rises by rather more in the UK, by 3.6, but by something like 9 percentage points in the other three large European countries. So I think it's clear, and it's obviously very well known, Britain is something of the odd one out. And one question I'd like to raise is, what does that really mean in the context of the European Union? That we are in a very different demographic position as far as this particular aspect is concerned. Will it in fact give us some kind of advantage in Britain? Or perhaps more charitably, does it suggest another possible kind of solidarity that is not across generations, but across countries? And is there scope for exchange? And Germany and France bring a strong currency, and we bring our youth. And that's perhaps a... But I think one can certainly imagine, possibly, that given that the UK certainly would be interested in fiscal transfers to compensate, say, for differential macroeconomic shocks under a fixed currency regime, so it might be that the other countries might be interested in fiscal transfers to help fund this particular problem. So I'd like to raise this question, what it's going to mean in the context of countries that are not simply sort of growing in parallel, but are in the European context. The second aspect which is different about the UK is, of course, even leaving aside the demographics. Britain is different in terms of its public spending. Denny says that the present system cannot last in its present form. But of course, in terms of public finances, the UK is, again, somewhat out of line. The table, for example, he showed us indicated that public spending would rise by 16% over the 30-year period, which presumably would be roughly at least of the kind of amount one would expect of growth of real GNP. And similarly, this comes up in the graphs which the OECD published a little while ago and the Guardian republished on Saturday, you may have seen. They had these graphs showing the expenditure on state pensions as proportion of GDP, showing it rising to 15% in Germany, 14% in France by 2025, whereas in Britain it sort of wobbles along at about 5%. Now, of course, that solution of the public finance problem has been achieved, or will be achieved, by the use of scaling down the basic state pension through the indexation of the pension to prices and not to earnings. It's been achieved by the scaling back of the state earnings related pension scheme. So of course, in a sense, this problem's been solved at the cost of reducing the adequacy of the state pension cover. And the question clearly is as to how far other means are going to provide for the gap that that's going to leave. So that the problem, in a sense, is going to reappear in the question of the adequacy of the pensions which we're providing. And of course, the current situation is already one where the UK is out of line in that the elderly have relatively higher poverty rates than the rest of the population compared to other European countries, like France, for example, where the poverty rate amongst the elderly is very slightly higher than the average, not much higher, and that reflects the fact that Denny referred to, that the level of pensioners' incomes as a whole is not much lower or maybe higher than that of the rest of the population. So this problem is one which, of course, reflects the fact that we have a very different experience of different groups amongst the pensioner population, a point which the recent Retirement Income Inquiry emphasised, the increasingly polarised population above the pension age. And this brings me to the last point, which is that of the differences that there are within the elderly population. It's very obvious that there are very different outcomes for people who start off ex ante. Some people have civil service or university teachers' pensions. Some people were employed by well-known newspaper publishers. Some people decide to invest in building societies that fold. Some people invest in building societies which issue shares and go public. Perhaps most importantly, of course, people differ in the fact that some people are fit and full possession of their powers at the age of 90, whereas others need 20 years of continuous nursing care. Now, this is very obvious, but I think one has to bear this in mind behind the rather macro picture, which to some extent I think Denny painted this evening, that he focused rightly on looking at the differences between generations, but within the generations there is considerable diversity in people's interests. It happens simply at the demographic level. Clearly, economists tend to have rather neat, tidy models where everyone, every family reproduces at the same rate. But of course, in fact, that's not the case. Many people have no direct descendants, certainly surviving descendants when they reach old age, whereas other people have quite a number. There's a considerable diversity, and this micro links may look rather different from the macro aspects in terms of looking at generations as an entity, as Denny did this evening. But it was a very stimulating lecture. One thing I should say the chairman didn't mention when describing our speaker's past career, he didn't mention that he was at one time part owner of a restaurant in Paris. And I want to finish by saying that in fact one ate very well in that restaurant when it was run by him. But also, I think we've been treated very well this evening and served a very rich menu indeed. Thank you.
Our second discussant is Professor David Bland, who is director of the Chartered Insurance Institute, and I'm sure he's rather relieved that he's a former Vice Chancellor of the University of Sheffield and therefore not having to deal with university finances at the moment. But he is currently visiting City University, where he takes a particular interest in the economics of insurance.
Thank you. Professor Kessler has done no less than I expected of him on this occasion, and Professor Atkinson, equally as I expected, has anticipated some of the same points I made, but fortunately I come from a different angle and can still make them. His first point referred to the special nature of the UK. I see this point becoming a major argument of the Eurosceptics once they get round to understanding it. If the UK is to have a natural advantage, a real natural advantage which spreads through to the middle of the next century, then the Eurosceptic will say that we have every reason to seek to avoid any pan-EU taxation or any integrative schemes for the European Union in terms of social security or pensions. This may look even more like a substantial argument to such people than most of the present case against federalism. And of course, the low level of state-old-age pensions in Britain, Ten Atkinson's second point, is a further macroeconomic fact that many Britons will be anxious to protect from any requirement under a future social chapter to move towards parity with the present level of Dutch or Italian pensions. An insidious potential influence on intergenerational transfers in the UK has been presaged by the rise of illegitimate births. This has risen, as you know, from 5% in 1960 to 30% in the early 90s. Although the Survey of Social Trends, which the government published last week, shows that the growth of illegitimacy has ceased to increase in the past year, from 1994 to 1995, that is, there are still some 21% of the population born in the decade 85 to 95 who are the children of single parents. Many mothers of such children later marry the fathers, especially in the higher income groups where cohabitation has become fashionable. But, on the other hand, the UK divorce rate at 3% at 3 per 1,000 population per year is almost double the EU average of 1.6 per 1,000 per year and is a full half of a person, 0.5 per 1,000 higher than in Denmark, the runner-up country. This pattern of illegitimacy and marriage breakdown, leading to single parenthood, in many cases intensifies the concentration of people who have no experience of a traditional intergenerational family structure, and this is especially concentrated in the lower socioeconomic categories. Combine this with all the well-worn cliches about a drug culture and a culture of violence, and one sees that the intergenerational pattern is changing significantly. Inheritance and the access of families to private education and to house ownership
which increasingly depends on the help of grandparents, will increasingly be marked as part of social stratification in this country. A very recent study by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, based on data from the National Child Development Survey, based on a sample of 20,000 individuals born in 1958, shows that this stratification is becoming very obvious indeed. Better education on the one hand, and the chances of prolonged unemployment on the other hand, were handed down in those families. People whose fathers were unemployed when they themselves reached a school leaving age of 16 were more than twice as likely to be unemployed themselves before they were 33 years old. If a standard working wage was indexed 100 in 1958, the year of the survey beginning, the son of a father receiving the average wage would grow up to receive 70 less than the son of a man who was paid 200 on the same index in 58. And the son of the poorer father, as I've just noted, also had a greater chance of being unemployed. A potentially violent and ill-educated minority running at one-fifth or so of the electorate will not even have met half their grandparents, will probably have received no notable benefit of significance of which they are aware from the grandparents that they do know, and may well be susceptible to crude propaganda in favour of an increasingly callous attitude to the aged, as was inferable from the way Denis Kessler presented that point. At the same time, family structures are becoming weaker in many cases. This is by no means confined to single parents or to absent parents, or even to the lower socioeconomic groups. In these cases, private intergenerational transfers over even one generation become increasingly irrelevant to that cohort of the population. It's not something I can attempt to quantify, but I do think it is a weighting factor, increasingly mirrored in the other member countries of the EU, which will affect the predictions which Denis Kessler has so well made in his speech. Thank you.
And can I now call upon Professor William Perodin, the Woolwich Professor of Financial Economics at Birkbeck College. And I think you're going to use the overhead, so you may need to pass slightly.
So I agree thoroughly with the previous discussants that it's an extremely interesting talk. It's a very wide-ranging talk, so it's quite difficult to respond to it since it covers so much ground. I should make two reasonably simple points. One is that I think it's important to analyze or think about demographic shocks of the sort that Professor Kessler is discussing within a slightly broader economic framework than he does. The second point I shall make is really that the important research agenda that the demographic shock and this sort of prospective crisis in the public finances of a whole number of different countries, the important research agenda that this raises is one of design of pension systems, and I think that this is a sort of thing to be stressed. Now, if I just review what Professor Kessler was talking about, one could sum up this crisis as the consequence of three elements. Firstly, the baby boom. Secondly, a decline in mortality, and thirdly, a breakdown in family care for the elderly, the weakening of links within families that led to effective intergenerational transfers by families themselves. Now, I shall really focus on the baby boom aspect of this. So it seems to me that there is quite a contrast between the way in which policymakers discuss these problems in public finances from the demographic shock, and the way that various academics have discussed this same topic. Policymakers tend to concentrate on demographic projections and on accounting calculations of the relative impact of these demographic developments on different generations. That's an extremely valuable starting point, but it's really an analysis of first-round effects. So a typical calculation would be to see what is the impact on contribution rates if replacement rates, retirement date, etc., are held constant, and one then ends up with rather worrying numbers. Now, the problem with this way of looking at things is that it ignores changes in factor prices, such as wages and interest rates, which may respond themselves very significantly to changes in the population profile. So, if I just give you a simple example, suppose that we have a bunch of generations. Each generation is overlapping with the next. Now, we suppose that there's a baby boom at a particular date, time t, and suppose that all the other generations are of a constant size. Now, if we think about this t generation, when the t generation is working, what is it working with? It's working with the capital, the plant and machinery that represents the accumulated savings of the t minus one generation. So there's a problem, because this large generation of baby boomers is working with a low per capita capital stock. Hence, its wages are likely to be relatively low. Now, when this generation retires, it's going to have its savings, which it will live off in its retirement. And at that point, the people who are using the savings, the plant and machinery that belong to this baby boom generation, it will be another small generation. So it will be a small generation with relatively few workers, so the plant and machinery will be not as productive as it might have been if there were more workers. So in other words, the baby boom generation, somebody was talking about people born in 1958, I suppose that's right in the middle of the baby boom generation. I was born in 1958, so I feel rather protective about the baby boomers, perhaps. The baby boomers suffer this double whammy in that wages tend to be relatively low, and when they're retired, the return on savings is relatively low. Now, the point is, really, that factor price effects, changes in the prices in the economy, may offset to quite a significant degree the first round effect. The first round effect is that if you are the generation after the baby boomers, you have to contribute a lot to pay for their retirement. The sort of second round effect, which is the impact on the economy of this demographic shock, may significantly offset that. So I think that if one does analyses using economic models that can take account of such feedbacks, then one tends to be a little less worried. The sort of impact on the different generations looks rather less worrying than if one simply reports figures from a generational accounting framework. Now, one has to be realistic about this. I mean, one has to be hard-nosed about the kind of appropriate policy response to a demographic shock that could, if the arguments I've been advancing are not completely correct, such a shock could destabilize public finances of various different countries. So I think that even if one believes, takes these arguments as completely convincing, still a sensible policymaker is going to have to be rather cautious in the next few decades. And I think it's pretty clear, given model uncertainty, that a sensible, hard-nosed policymaker is going to be looking for ways of cutting back the various pension schemes in these different countries. So this brings me really to my second point, that the really important issue now is how we should go about cutting back pension schemes. The kind of basic and crucial factor is that we should certainly try and design the kind of cutbacks in pension schemes so that we don't create poverty amongst the old. But given that, if we take that as some sort of constraint on the way in which we alter pension schemes, we still have a whole lot of dimensions. We have contribution rates, replacement rates, averaging periods, retirement dates, rules on the supply of labour after retirement. And these need to be considered in these various different countries. I mean, if one looks at the schemes just in Europe, there's a very wide range of different setups, different precise arrangements. And they are more or less distortionary at a micro level. And the overall generosity of the scheme varies a great deal as well. So it seems to me that that there really is a challenge to economists working in this area to respond to the situation extremely well described by Professor Kessler. It seems to me that one has to decide, first of all, how to redesign pension schemes in order to minimize the microeconomic distortions implicit in these various schemes. And secondly, one needs to decide what is an appropriate scale for or level of generosity for the scheme as a whole. So I think I probably have run out of time. I was going to talk slightly more about this, but it seems to me that there really is a significant need for studies of these different aspects, and that it's important to go beyond the generational accounting framework and to look at things in a more economic framework.
And finally, if I could ask Professor Pierre Pestio from the University of Liège to complete the comments on the paper.
Yeah, being the fourth discussant, I knew that it would be very difficult for me to be original. My only originality is going to be the accent. Denis Kessler has provided us with a very stimulating survey of some central questions pertaining to the general issue of redistribution and conflicts between generations. The exposition was very clear, and the knowledge it displayed of economic theory, history, demography, and social institutions is extremely impressive. I am very sympathetic to the view that there exists the potential for generational conflicts, and to prevent them, one needs to adopt long-lasting and structural measures. To do so, we first have to understand past trends and current behavior. Denis Kessler's lecture greatly contributes to such an understanding. My speedy comment is going to bear on four issues that mainly deal with social security and retirement. Those issues are the following. Is demographics the problem? Can we count on bequests and gifts to offset the expected decline in retirement benefits? Third, can we debate on intergenerational redistribution in the same way as on intragenerational redistribution? And finally, what's the impact of European integration on redistribution across generations? First, what's the problem? It's often argued that demographic aging per se is not really a problem. Accordingly, the post-73 slowdown in productivity growth would be the key reason why intergenerational redistribution has become a major policy issue. The expected increase in the dependency rate is due to the choice of a rigid early retirement age. With current life expectancy, the length of retirement adjusted for health is much higher than when social security schemes were introduced. In other words, one could easily postpone effective retirement age from its current level, that is below 16 in a number of countries. This is not done because of unemployment and economic stagnation. If real wages grew at an annual rate of, say, 3%, and unemployment decreased, future generations would be able to carry a rising fiscal burden and still be better off than we are. Hence, the generational problems we are facing are not exclusively demographic, but also economic. Given that we could face a persistent slowing of growth, what should be the optimal redistribution? Why was it impossible in a number of countries to develop demographic reserves and prepare the population to postpone retirement age? In my view, pay-as-you-go social security, which is, as a principle, a marvelous instrument, looks more and more like a car whose steering wheel would be stuck rightward, that is, towards transfers from the younger to the older generation. Bequests and gifts create strong intergenerational linkages. They can be viewed as the private counterpart of public transfers, such as Social Security and national debt, that Denis Kessler showed at length. The quantitative importance and the qualitative nature of bequests and gifts have some bearing on the issue of redistribution across generations. For example, if children provide less support for their own parents now than they did before Social Security existed, Social Security may have much less of an intergenerational effect than the data would suggest. The important wealth held today by elderly people is thus viewed as a partial solution to the expected decline in Social Security benefits. Retirees in the future will receive bequests from their parents and support from their children. This nice scenario calls for two caveats. First, not everyone can expect to inherit. The distribution of bequests is known to be as concentrated as that of wealth. Thus, relying on bequests to compensate for falling retirement benefits is very unfair. Second, even though one can show that before Social Security, children used to support their elderly parents, one cannot be sure that this linkage will reproduce itself. One rarely observes symmetry in social behavior. My third point is the relation between inter- and intragenerational redistribution of income. At first sight, there seems to be no difference between redistributing from rich to poor at one point of time and redistributing from a well-to-do generation to an unfavored one. Yet one observes a number of divergences, both factual and conceptual. I'm not going to elaborate about that. Let me just mention that it's much easier to measure the redistributive incidence of social policy across households than across generations. And in a recent paper which attempts to decompose the annuity and the transfer components of Social Security in the US, Ed Wolf assessed the strong redistributive effect of Social Security benefits among the elderly. Yet, between generations, he can only observe an effect a la Kotlikoff, a transfer from the younger to the older generation. Many suspect that this is regressive, but it seems founded on the assumptions that productivity growth and employment will slack. In any case, there is no value per se in a policy that is neutral with respect to intergenerational distribution, which is implicit to generational accounting literature. Similarly, why would we have a social policy that would not attempt to modify the distribution of income? My view is that the main case for government's action is redistribution across households and between generations. Let me come to the last point, which is the question of whether European integration is good for or not for intergenerational redistribution. I would answer positively to this question, at least for the time being. We know that European integration, and in particular factor mobility, makes it difficult to conduct redistributive policies. Fiscal competition leads to what has been called social dumping. And as argued by Denis Kessler, large differences in contributions or in benefits between countries can induce perverse migrations. On the other hand, the famous Maastricht convergence criteria forces countries that are heavily indebted to reduce their deficit and their indebtedness. Without Maastricht, I'm not sure that Belgium, my country, or Italy would have adopted the type of fiscal policy they have today. Whether those criteria are too drastic, I mean the Maastricht criteria, and should be partially relaxed to avoid deflation is likely, but the general pressure is quite good. In that respect, Europe has a positive effect on intergenerational redistribution, even though its effect on intragenerational redistribution goes the other way. By the way, I would like to mention about one of the previous discussants who mentioned that England was in a good position towards the other countries of Europe. I mean, we have exactly the same problem in Belgium. I mean, you know that Belgium is splitting, or tended to be to split right now, just for the same reasons. I mean, one of the two communities thinks that it's in better shape in terms of demographic structure and towards social protections and the social security system. Well, what the other community says, which is the French-speaking community I'm coming from, is that, well, you may be right now, but wait a little bit. In a few decades, this is going to be the other way around. I would say the same thing for the British. I mean, maybe they would be in good shape right now in a few decades, but in more several decades, this will be the other way around. I mean, this is the issue of commitment and long-lasting contract that we should have between regions or between countries. Well, Professor Kessler's lecture provides an important and valuable contribution to one of the most difficult challenges of the coming decades. Let's hope that his call for active management of intergenerational issues will be heard by policymakers and citizens.
I'm afraid I have to report that I have an extremely difficult distributional task now, because I know there are many of you in the audience who would like to contribute to the discussion, and there have been many points raised both by the lecture and by the comments made on it. I unfortunately have minus 10 minutes to distribute amongst you. So what I suggest is that there is a reception upstairs in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor. You can make your way there by lift or by stairs, depending on how you feel about which generation should be given preference. So in conclusion, if I could just ask Professor Kessler just to say two or three words in response, but then perhaps we could continue the discussion upstairs on the fifth floor over a glass of wine.
First, I wish to thank you, John, for having organized this meeting. I know you devoted a lot of time to set up everything, and so please, thank you. I wish also to thank, of course, the four discussants with not only the problem of reading the papers and listening to it, and afterwards commenting it. It's a lot of work, too. Let me stress four points. First, I agree with Tony Atkinson. I think that the diversity of intragenerational situations must be taken care for, but it would have added half an hour at least to what I said. So I fully agree with you. I think we should never forget, when we isolate one viable generation, not to think about the other size of the generation, with the intragenerational distribution, for instance, of income, wealth, well-being, and so on. Second, I agree with you about the diversity of demographic structure, but I must say that UK is quite isolated, because when you look at all industrialized countries, it's true that the demographic development in UK appears quite different from the rest of the countries. It has certainly lots of implications in the future. I see one at least. When you invest abroad, I think that the problem of the demographic structure of the country where you invest will in the future be a very important variable. In other words, I mean, if you invest in a young country, I'm quite sure that it will be more favorable than when you invest, for instance, a pension fund in a country that will know a very important process of aging. Third, I agree with David Bland. I totally didn't talk about what I call the qualitative relations between generations. I only talked about the quantitative relations about generations, transfers, taking the forms of money, time, but I didn't talk about the unstable families, I didn't talk about divorce, I didn't talk about single families, single parents. And of course, I mean, it is quite striking to see that the instability of the family appeared exactly when the birth rate declined. And it seems that we should be I should pay more attention to the relationship in between the quantitative evolutions and the qualitative evolutions of the family. I must say also that part of the explanation of the divorce lies certainly in the fact that the life duration has increased and that we have to be careful before getting married, for instance. May I just say one word? I mean, still, you have to know that in most EEC countries, the duration of marriage is inferior to the duration of life insurance contracts, which means that Europeans prefer the insurer to their husband, to their spouse. At least that's a nice event. Third, I fully agree with Mr. Perraudin and also Pierre Pasteur about the fact that we should integrate macroeconomic developments with demographic developments. As a matter of fact, I did quite a few models on this issue. I did refer to in my lecture. But I don't agree with what you say, Mr. Perraudin. Even when you devise demographico-economic model, the importance of demographics is such that even very strong economic developments cannot offset part of what the demographics do. For instance, just one word, if you had to offset by a rise in productivity the increased burden of aging on Social Security, the productivity of the young generations, you know, just to maintain the well-being of the generations without diminishing their well-being. So you have an increase of taxes, and you say, well, what's the rate of increase of their income, so as to be sure to offset the increased burden of taxes. You end up with a rise in productivity that would be about 7 to 8% per year over the next 35 years. And to my point of view, you can imagine how difficult it is to reach a growth rate of 7 or 8% per year over such a long period of time, just to avoid that the increased burden lies on future generations' shoulders. I agree also with everything that has been said. I will just conclude. I don't know why. Each time I come to the UK, it's a great pleasure for me. I was here recently about 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago. Whatever the topic, I can talk about sex, I can talk about food, I can talk about sport, I can talk about volcanic activity. UK is different. And so, I mean, UK is different. And each time, whatever I talk, sex, food, sport, brandy, volcanic activity, the question is, why should we join the European Union? I don't know. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. One final comment. Those of you who do not have a copy of the paper and who would like it, if you were to give me up in the reception on the fifth floor a copy of your address or your business card, I'd be will arrange for a copy to be sent to you. But otherwise, on behalf of everybody here, can I thank Professor Kessler very much for the lecture. Thank you.